The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. For part of today's program, I want to share with you some articles that readers have submitted, and these are articles that deal with family businesses. And the first, The Making of Hill Brothers Grocery, and this is submitted by Lynn Hanna. Always give your best and follow your dream. My dad practiced this from an early age. As I catch a glimpse of the box cutter in my junk drawer, I think of my dad. My dad, William Neal Hill, owned a small-town grocery store from 1957 to 1999. Box cutters made his work easier. Boxes of fresh produce from the farmer's market were delivered and opened, and the contents were put out in baskets or bins for display. Then all the boxes had to be broken down. Now I use my box cutter to open packages delivered to my house. It feels insignificant in comparison. Dad's box cutter symbolized a hard-working man who came from nothing, but through perseverance and a strong work ethic, he excelled. In a family with six siblings, Dad grew up with little more than his dreams and determination. He was the school supply store manager in high school. I like to think it was a setting him up for his future career. He graduated after the 11th grade and worked with his brother to help his family. In his 20s, Dad bought a building in Buford, Georgia, and opened Hill's Grocery. His brother owned a grocery store in nearby Dacula, Georgia. They later renamed both their businesses Hill Brothers Grocery. Dad quickly met most of the people in town and developed a solid customer base. He learned customer names and all about their families. During that time, he also met a young woman, Linda Puckett, who worked at the bank across the street. After dating a short while, they married and she later became my mom. Dad unloaded trucks, transferred pallets of canned goods, stocked shelves, worked the register, and swept floors. He hired employees as his business grew, but employees do not always ease your load. One late night, the county police called my dad. They had apprehended a man attempting to break into the store. The perpetrator was one of his employees. He had the bright idea to break in through the roof, but he got stuck. Dad allowed customers to purchase groceries on credit. This doesn't mean they used credit cards. Customers gathered their groceries and took them home. Then later, they came back and paid when they had money. Dad kept their signed receipts in a box near the register until they were paid. He understood how difficult it could be to make ends meet. I grew up working in the store. Every Saturday morning, I pretended to be asleep, hoping my parents would feel sorry for me and let me take the day off. It took a while for me to be grateful for the opportunities I was given. Dad had a saying, "The customer is always right." I managed to treat customers as if they were right, even when I didn't believe it. One challenging customer liked to put his cigar in his mouth and let the smoke drift into my face while he slowly counted his money. I'm not sure if I was more annoyed by the smoke or by how slowly he counted his money. By the way, smoking was allowed in stores when I was growing up in the 1970s. My dad passed away in 2010. He gave his best and achieved his dream, and I'm proud to be his daughter. Our next story is submitted by John Scanlon, and it's titled, The Start of a Family Business. My dad ran the Scanlon Company from the end of our dining room table. In a home located on Grest Road near Stoutsville, Ohio, he operated a heating, air conditioning, and refrigeration business that ruled South Central Ohio in the 1970s. But the company's humble beginnings made a very touching story seem funny. Dad started the company on June 5, 1970, which happened to also be my only sister's 5th birthday. And it was no accident that Dad took her to work with him in Columbus that morning. For the occasion, Mom had dressed Kathy in her prettiest pink dress, and then Dad and Kathy were out the door. They drove to Dad's soon-to-be former employer, where Dad walked into his boss's office with Kathy and gave him the news. He was quitting to form the Scanlon Company. Then Dad departed and bought Kathy lunch, followed by a stop at Lombardi's Ice Cream. There, Kathy ordered a vanilla chocolate swirl ice cream cone. At Lombardi's, a sketch artist just happened to have set up shop, and Dad paid him to draw a portrait of his only daughter. Kathy has that drawing to this very day. That afternoon, Dad officially started the Scanlon Company from the end of our dining room table. To his right, front, across the dining room, there sat a telephone, just begging to be called. Unfortunately, it was the same number as the Scanlon family residence. Thus, with every ring, Dad didn't know if it was an impending service call or the neighbor boys asking to play baseball. That telephone sat atop a giant clunky answering machine that covered for Dad when he wasn't in the office. To Dad's right was an antique adding machine sat on a small roll-top desk. I can still see Dad pulling back on the adding machine's arm with each noisy calculation. On Dad's left sat another roll-top desk, this one containing an ancient black typewriter. That was the primary tool for the Scanlon Company's lone unpaid secretary, administrator, hunt and peck typist, bookkeeper, and office assistant. Mom. Lastly, on Dad's end of the dining room table, a half-moon shape containing all kinds of folders and files. Unfortunately, the Scanlon family still ate nightly evening meals at that same table, but we managed. Our last story about family businesses is submitted by Sarah Etchen Baker, and it's titled All in the Family. As I flip through the yellowed pages of my grandmother's scrapbooks, a curious sense of connection tingled down my spine. The faded photographs and handwritten notes chronicled my grandfather's journey from a humble plumber at Dallas-based Treadwell Plumbing and Heating Company in 1922 to the founder of Dollar Plumbing based out of his home on Hondo Street near downtown Dallas. With my grandmother's clerical skills and his plumbing abilities, Edwin Etkin Sr. business grew and thrived in the city well into the 1930s, despite the Great Depression. Following in his father's footsteps, my dad, Edwin Etkin Jr., took up the plumbing trade, working for Tedder Plumbing Company in the Lakewood area of Dallas during the 1950s and 60s. A turn of events in the 1970s led Maurice Tedder to sell his client list and a service truck to my dad. Eddie's Plumbing Service was born, and like his father, Edwin Jr., set up business in our family home on 3rd Street in Garland, Texas. With mother by his side, his plumbing business flourished until he retired in 1985. The legacy of plumbing expertise seems natural to both men and flowed seamlessly down the Etchen lineage, an expertise that seemingly stretched beyond the mundane world of pipes and fittings. And the next story I have for you is presented by Francine Miswa, and it's titled A Tale of Two Kitchens. I thought this was a really sweet story, so I hope you enjoy it. It all began in January 1949 when my grandparents, Renario and Francis D'Antonio, and their daughter, Dolores, moved into their newly built two-story brick building on Main Street in Monongahela, Pennsylvania. The restaurant that previously occupied this lot had been destroyed by fire, and shortly thereafter, the owners put the property up for sale. Rennerio and Francis decided to establish their business on the first floor and live on the second floor. They dreamed of opening a bar and restaurant to take advantage of the bustling crowd of mill and factory workers traveling through the town. Rennerio was a cobbler and had established a small business near Monongahela. He also worked at the local factory only minutes away. They began planning the layout of the first floor. The space was enormous and would contain a bar, dining room, and kitchen. My grandparents chose to call their bar and restaurant the Sportsman's Cafe. This was a good American name that people would remember. My grandmother, whom we called Nona, was an excellent cook and prepared meals in the cafe. My grandfather, Nono, tended to the bar and worked shifts at Denora Steel Mill. The business became well established and provided extra income while Dolores grew up. Dolores was engaged to be married in June and planned to move into a small apartment a few streets down from her parents' home. Nona had heart problems all her life after the age of 12 when she got rheumatic fever. Nona depended on Dolores to help with the household chores because of her health problems. Dolores and Americo Sion were married June 9, 1949. They spent the first 6 months of their marriage traveling back and forth between their apartment and the cafe as they helped with chores in her parents' home and business. Dolores and Americo put aside plans to move into another apartment or purchase a home and decided to move in with her parents. Dolores and her mother agreed that if they moved in with them, Dolores would have her own kitchen, directly across the hall from Nona's kitchen. This allowed Dolores to prepare her meals for her husband and remain independent from her parents. When Americo came home from his job at the box shop in New Eagle, he noticed the aromas while climbing the stairs to their apartment. Both women were cooking dinner for their families. Many times the dinners were something different in each kitchen. 1 year after they moved in, Dolores gave birth to the first of her four children. I was their first daughter, and they named me Francine after her grandmother, Frances. I grew up with two kitchens and twice as many memories as most people. The variety of food was endless, and I could choose to eat at either kitchen or many times at both. Breakfast were always in Nona's kitchen. I still remember some of the dishes she served me, especially when I was attending school. I shared a special bond with my grandmother. Besides working the mill and running the cafe, my grandparents supplemented their income by making liqueurs, particularly a drink we called Coffee Sport. Whiskey Joe, the local bootlegger, supplied the homemade whiskey and delivered it in 1 gallon glass jugs. Nona could not stand for long periods, so one of my jobs in the kitchen was to stand on a stool and stir the mixture until it was the correct consistency. I was 9 years old at the time, but I remember it vividly. For the first 10 years of my life, I moved between the two kitchens. If my mother was baking something, I helped her mix the ingredients. Other times, I helped my Nona make pasta. Both my grandparents passed away when I was 10 years old. I was sad when the one kitchen was converted to a bedroom to accommodate our growing family. I ended up with a sister and two brothers. My father eventually closed the bar on the first floor, and the license was sold after he realized that raising four children would be a challenge, and doing it over bar would have been a disaster. My little sister was born just as I graduated from high school. I helped my mother with my brothers and sister. My sister was only 3 years old when I was ready to marry. My future husband and I started searching for an apartment to move into once we were married. During a visit to see my parents, my husband asked me to look at the empty bar room. The space where the bar had been located included a large kitchen, dining room, and a large bar room. The outline of the bar was visible on the floor, and the paint on the wall behind the bar outlined the mirror that once hung there. In the back corner of the bar room was a low wooden semicircular platform where the go-go girls had once danced. My brother, Robert, and I would set up a short ladder in the narrow alley outside the bar and look through the louvers of the huge exhaust fan to watch the girls dancing on the little stage. We smelled the thick odor of cigarettes and beer as the fan blew our hair back while we watched the girls dance. My husband and I decided to transform the bar into an apartment. We finished it a few weeks before we were married. When we were done, we had a beautiful two-bedroom apartment. The two restrooms were combined into one large bathroom. Walls were constructed and sectioned off the living area. Cabinets were added in the kitchen, and the apartment was carpeted. My Nona would have approved, especially since my kitchen was directly below my mother's on the second floor. We lived there for 10 years and started our family there. Our daughter Stephanie was born while we lived there. She often went between my kitchen and my mother's. After we moved out, my father rented the apartment a few times, and both my brothers lived there for a while. But it was never the same as when I grew up there. Even today, I can remember racing down the hall after school to see what was cooking in the two kitchens. It was the best time to be a young girl in our family when we all lived together and had two kitchens. And now I want to share some information with you about VJ Day, the official end to World War II. Germany surrendered to Allied forces in early May 1945, but it was several months before Japan surrendered, marking the long-awaited end to World War II. VJ Day, which stands for Victory Over Japan, celebrated Japan's surrender, but in some accounts you may see two consecutive days marking this event. That's because President Harry S. Truman announced the surrender on August 14, 1945, while, because of time zone differences, Japanese Emperor Hirohito's broadcast happened the next day. Hence, several countries recognize August 15th as VJ Day. The actual signing of the surrender agreement happened on September 2nd aboard the USS Missouri, which is the designated day the United States recognizes VJ Day. Here are a few other little-known facts. The famous Life magazine photograph of a U.S. sailor kissing a nurse in Times Square was taken while millions of people celebrated the news. The photographer didn't get the names of the two people, and numerous people have claimed to be them. The Treaty of San Francisco, formally establishing peaceful relations between Japan and the Allied powers, didn't happen until September 8, 1951. And some Japanese soldiers on isolated Pacific islands continued to fight, with the last known Japanese soldier not surrendering until 1974. And next, I have an article for you from Good Old Days on the Radio. This is for Eve Arden, teacher extraordinaire. Actress Eve Arden often played the smart, quick-witted woman, never ruffled and always on top of any situation. Arden proved how versatile she could be in front of the camera by accepting dramatic offerings as well as comedy. Today, fans of Eve Arden know her best as sassy Connie Brooks, the lovesick schoolteacher of Madison High in the weekly sitcom Our Miss Brooks, which started as a radio show in 1948 before being adapted for television in 1952. Miss Brooks taught English to 10th graders and was loved by real school teachers and students who listened in each week and could relate. Miss Brooks found herself trying to resolve comical situations at Madison High, usually clashing with Principal Osgood Conklin, played by character actor Gail Gordon. In an era when George Burns, Gracie Allen, Jack Benny, and Milton Berle dominated television screens, Eve Arden successfully carried the lead on Our Miss Brooks with a comedic persona that was truly original. Peers in her field were either the straight woman or the comedian, but Arden successfully combined both. Joining the antics at Madison High was Walter Denton, played by Richard Crenna, the student who was trying to leave his mark on the world. Whether he started a campaign to improve the food in the school cafeteria or pushed to have Miss Brooks named Teacher of the Year, he convinced Miss Brooks to help in the cause du jour. Miss Brooks only had eyes for Philip Boynton, played on radio by Jeff Chandler and Robert Rockwell, and on TV by Rockwell. The bashful biology teacher, a science nerd who never took time to learn about the birds and the bees. In one episode, Miss Brooks starts a quarrel with Mr. Boynton so a loving reconciliation could take place. Her efforts are in vain when the biology teacher proves he only has eyes for his pet frog, McDougal. After 3 years on television, Our Miss Brooks began slipping in the ratings, and in desperation, the setting was changed. Madison High was raised for a highway project, so Miss Brooks found a new job at Mrs. Nestor's private elementary school. For reasons that were never disclosed, Osgood Conklin transferred to the same school as the new principal, and many of her former students were still on hand to establish the comical situations. Mr. Boynton was replaced with a young physical education teacher, Jean Talbot, played by Jean Barry, who chased after Miss Brooks. The new format never worked, and after polling the viewers, the producers brought back Mr. Boynton for the final weeks of the program. In 1956, Warner Brothers released a big-screen movie based on the radio and television programs, with most of the television cast reprising their screen roles. The film closed with Miss Brooks succeeding in capturing the affections of Mr. Boynton, resulting in a wedding between the two. Sadly, the radio and TV program never had this union. Now, you can receive a free 30-minute classic radio episode of Our Miss Brooks, which is courtesy of Good Old Days magazine. To get this download, go to www.classicradioclub.com, and this is available until August 31st of 2025. And next, I want to share with you some information about World's Fairs, which are showcases of innovation and culture. Although many people have heard of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, or the 1939 New York World's Fair, the United States has actually hosted more than two dozen World's Fairs, plus many more expos and exhibitions. World's Fairs of the past were huge events that people traveled hundreds of miles to visit. Block after block showcased new and exciting innovations in technology, culture, and food. Gleaming pavilions displayed exhibits of the future or cultural artifacts from faraway countries. Some of today's most popular items were first showcased at World's Fairs, including the following. Zipper. Invented earlier but introduced at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair, the zipper was at that time called the slide fastener or clasp locker. Cotton candy. At the 1904 St. Louis World Fair, the Electric Candy Machine Company created the sweet and fluffy concoction by spinning strands of liquefied sugar into a heated bowl. People were hesitant to try it at first, thinking it was actually cotton. Television. TV officially made its debut at the 1939 New York World's Fair, where RCA sent a telecast from the fairgrounds in Queens to its headquarters in Manhattan. And lastly, Ford Mustang. Arguably the most popular American sports car, the Mustang was unveiled at the 1964 New York World's Fair to the overwhelming delight of the young post-war generation. Our next story is submitted by Donald Tanner, and it is titled The Not Joyride. In the summer of 1957, my family lived in a West Virginia hollow called Pigeon Creek. My family was a large one, and over the years it kept growing. My oldest brother, Dennis, was in the Army. It was always a special occasion for our family, but especially for me when he came home for a visit. Dennis was 12 years older than me. After the birth of three girls before I came along, I'm sure he was relieved that he finally had a brother. While he was on leave, I tried to spend as much time as I could with Dennis, though I'm sure he had other interests besides hanging out with his 9-year-old brother. One day, we brothers were in our family car, a 1948 Ford, and Dennis asked me if I wanted to drive. Of course I did. After I was behind the driver's wheel, I realized my feet couldn't touch the pedals. I scooted down as much as I could and placed my feet on the gas pedal. I could hardly see over the wheel and out the front window, but that wasn't going to stop me. I started the car, pressed on the gas, and away we went down an old dirt road. I thought I was doing well for my first driving lesson. Our house was on the other side of a shallow creek. I felt like I was by that time an experienced driver. I took off through the water, over the rocks, and up a small embankment. I was really driving now. Suddenly, I saw our house looming before me on the little hill. I quickly slipped down in the seat and hit the brakes. That old Ford slid in the muddy ground. Finally, I managed to stop the runaway vehicle just about an inch from the cellar, where most of our home-canned fruits and vegetables were stored. My first attempt at driving a car was not exactly the joyride that I have envisioned, but it was one that I have never forgotten. To end the program, I got a trivia question for you. Do you remember who starred in the 1953 film Roman Holiday? The answer? Audrey Hepburn as Princess Anne and Gregory Peck as Joe Bradley. Filmed in Rome, the movie features some famous Italian landmarks, including the Trevi Fountain and the Spanish Steps. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And I thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.